So the first question that I had was, we now have all of these tools at our disposal for probing our own biology and our genetics. We have whole genome sequencing and RNA sequencing and GWAS studies and on and on and on it goes. But I guess I'm just wondering, what are the limitations of all these tools? And is there an aspect of biology that we would like to better understand, but we just don't have the methods for exploring? Or is it more that we just need time and money as well to bring together all of these tools and analyze all the data that's being generated?
I think that each of these tools, when you look at them separately, they have various limitations and disadvantages, but they also have great advantages. For example, if you look at genome-wide association studies, the obvious advantages would be that it's relatively cheap to do. It's relatively easy to analyze. It provides you some sort of picture of your entire genome, but it doesn't provide the full picture. It just gives you hints or clues to where there is a genetic effect, but you don't know what in the region that the genome-wide association study is talking about, what is the cause of this effect. So this would be a limitation. The thing is that when you combine together many of these methods, then the picture that you're getting is much better. And many of the other methods that you mentioned, like whole genome sequencing and things like that, they're still a bit more expensive and difficult to do. And when you're studying a disease like Parkinson's disease, which is very heterogeneous, and you need to have a very large number of patients and controls in order to do proper genetic study, then it becomes very expensive. And it also creates a huge amount of data that we are still limited in our ability to analyze and to understand. While we do understand many things that happens within the areas that are encoding in the areas in the DNA that encodes the genes from which proteins are being translated, we do understand that pretty well, but we don't understand what happens in the rest of the genome, which is about 97% of the genome. And the amount of data that is created is huge. And to analyze it properly, we need resources, we need tools that we still don't have. I would say we don't have very good ones. We have some tools that we can use, but there's still a lot of work to be done on developing tools, developing storage, developing new ways to look at things. Things like machine learning and artificial intelligence that are slowly getting into this picture may help, for example.
So are the biggest limitations our ability to analyze the data rather than to collect the data?
Well, the limitation in collecting the data is basically money and collecting enough patients. So if we, and this is something that we are doing. Now, today there are large consortia of Parkinson's disease, like the International Parkinson's Disease Genomics Consortium, IPDGC, that together we have, I don't know, I guess probably more than 30,000 patients, over 1 million controls. So it's a large enough population. So we can solve the first issue of having enough patients to study, but the second issue of the funding for it, if we really want to do proper genetic study that will include all the data that we need in order to understand everything, the cost is still very large. That's the limitation on so the limitation is not technical. It's not that we still need new methods. We have the methods. They're just a bit too expensive at this point. So the main technical limitation remains, like you asked, how to analyze the data, how to work with the data. That's still something that is being developed.
Okay, now this might be an impossible question to answer, but let's say we did the full analysis and we collected all the data that we needed to and we analyzed it as thoroughly as possible. What would that tell us? What would we know then that we don't know today?
Well, We already know quite a lot, so that's a good, in a way, it's a good question because we do know quite a lot, but we still don't know. We know, for example, if we look at the recent genome-wide association studies and those that are about to be published, I'm involved in the largest one. So there will be many new genetic, many new areas in the genome that will be implicated in Parkinson's disease that have a contribution for the risk for Parkinson's disease. But we don't understand, we don't know what's within these regions is the cause. So we need to use several tools. Like for example, if I had all the money that that is needed, for example, I would do whole genome sequencing and I would do RNA sequencing and I will do methylation studies and other epigenetic studies on all patients. And then you have to combine all this data together. And that's the major limitation. But how to combine it and how to analyze it all together, it's still something that, that it is difficult. So so we don't know quite a lot. We don't know what happens within all these regions and what are the effects. You know, there's a genetic variation that, for example, increases the risk by 30%, okay? But we don't know how it does that. For example, is it because the expression, this variant can affect the expression of the protein in different areas of the brain, for example, or another regulatory mechanism? So there are many ways in that, you know, the genetic variants can affect your risk for a disease. So we're still very, very much behind in understanding what are those. So we know where in the genome where the areas in which there are genetic factors that affect the risk, but we don't know what is the exact genetic factor and we don't know how
okay. It affects the risk. When it comes though to developing interventions, is genetics enough or are we gonna have to eventually figure out how to incorporate environmental and lifestyle factors into our understanding?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we geneticists, we always think that everything is genetic. But it's not, and obviously environment has a larger contribution than genetics in Parkinson's disease. And this is something that we can already quantify when we measure heritability of Parkinson's disease. So we measure what is the contribution out of all the factors that cause Parkinson's disease, what is the contribution of genetic factors. And this contribution, I think it's around 25 to 30%. So it means that most factors that cause Parkinson's disease are non-genetic. So, of course, to fully understand the disease, we will need to understand all the environmental factors. We are aware of some of them. Some that are increasing the risk, like exposure to pesticides and insecticides and heavy metals and things like that. Dairy also, and we know of things that are reducing the risk. But again, our understanding there is very limited. And this is actually more difficult to do because, you know, in genetics, when you look at genetics, you either have a variant or you don't have a variant, and it's very easy to test. Mm-hmm. But when you start looking at epidemiological data, at all these environmental exposures, they're a lot more difficult to measure, to quantify. We have to rely on people's memory, what they were exposed to. You know, people who have Parkinson's today, their disease could have started 20, 30 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. So they need to remember what they were exposed to then, what was their, you know, what was their diet then, what did they eat? So it's very, very challenging. And the way to do it is probably by huge prospective studies where people are being followed up prospectively for many, many years. I'm talking about dozens of years. And then we can combine their genetic data. We can combine the data that we collect on the different environmental factors that are exposed to. But we will have to do it because that's, as I said, that's the major contribution to Parkinson's. And these things are, probably some of them are modifiable.
Okay.
That we can change.
Now, all of that, though, is basically population studies. When it comes to an individual, do we have any way of measuring how much a genetic variant is responsible for their individual disease? are any of these tools being developed?
Yeah, so we have yeah, so we can quantify the risk that is related to every variant. And from that risk for every variant, we can build something that is called genetic risk score. And we can assign this risk score per individual. So I can take my own DNA, do the test, do genetic testing, and based on the variants that I find in my own DNA, I can give myself a score of what is my genetic risk score, or how all these variants combined, how do they affect my risk to develop Parkinson's. But the ability of this genetic risk score to predict who will actually develop Parkinson's is not very high.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I can tell you based on genetics what I can give a score per individual. But because, as I said, because most of the contribution is non-genetic, the ability of this to predict is much lower. But there are several studies. So these tools, they exist already. Yeah, we can do it. And there are several studies that combine genetic and clinical variables. If you measure, if you take a person's genetic data and you combine it with all kinds of clinical variables, for example, smell test, for example, blood pressure, sleep measurements, all kinds of things like that, then your ability to predict who will develop Parkinson's is much, much, much higher.
Okay. But I had heard that there are some tests or something, or some diagnostic tests being done, I think using iPS cells, where we might actually be able to measure how much a specific variant is actually influencing the biology, the cellular biology. Do you know where we are in those developments?
Yeah, so iPS cells is a very neat tool that allows you to sample, to take a blood sample, for example, and create neurons out of it using stem cells that you collect from the blood. You collect mononuclear cells and you create from them stem cells, and from them you can create neurons.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can basically see how the genetic variants that are found in that individual that you took the cells from, how they affect different biological functions. But it is still difficult to isolate the exact effect of a single variant, because there are many things. Let's say, for example, we create those iPSCs and we want to measure how genetic variants affect the accumulation of alpha-synuclein, which is the protein that accumulates in Parkinson's. We can measure that in cells. So let's say, so we take a person and we know he has this variant in a gene that causes Parkinson's, like GBA.
Mm-hmm.
And we measure it. But then if we take another person with the exact same mutation in GBA, the measurement could be different, because there are many other genetic factors that these people have that are different between them, then that they can also affect the accumulation of alpha-synuclein or any other biological function that we measure. So it's very difficult to isolate the effect of the genetic variant that we're looking at. But also for this, there's a solution that is starting to be used, which is using a CRISPR method. I don't know if you heard about CRISPR.
Yeah.
To generate isogenic controls, in which isogenic controls are, let's say, if we take again the example of a person with a mutation in the GBA gene.
Mm-hmm.
So using CRISPR, we can reverse this mutation only this mutation. So the entire genome we can create two cell lines. One cell line will be with the mutation and the other one will be without it.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, they would be completely different. They would be completely the same, sorry, exactly identical. So that allows us to isolate the effect of a specific variant. The problem is that this method is still, it's relatively new, so it's still not perfect, but this is something that I believe will be solved in the next few years.
Okay.
To make it more easy to produce these cells.
Okay. Now moving on to something else that you study a lot, REM sleep behavior disorder. I was just wondering how two conditions that seem so different, like REM sleep behavior disorder and Parkinson's, can have a similar risk factor.
Well, you have to remember that REM sleep behavior disorder, I will call it RBD from now,
mm-hmm.
RBD is a symptom. It's a symptom of, you can consider it as a symptom of synucleinopathy. Mm-hmm. So it's just like there are many symptoms that are that Parkinson's patients have that are non-motor, right? Unlike RBD, they are very they are not specific, like loss of smell, like constipation, like things like that. So also so you can ask the same question about constipation, right? How can you explain constipation and Parkinson's disease?
Yeah.
But this is just a symptom. It means that an area in the brain that controls REM sleep is affected. And that's why they have the REM sleep behavior disorder.
Okay.
But otherwise, it's the same disease, just in different phase of the disease.
How well do they correlate? I mean, how likely is somebody who has REM sleep behavior disorder going to develop Parkinson's?
So if you have properly diagnosed RBD, which means that you have history of enacting your dreams, and you went to a sleep lab and they measured your brain activity and they measured your muscle activity and they proved that during REM sleep, mm-hmm. your voluntary muscles are supposed to be paralyzed. That's the norm. So if they're not, and then when you dream, you will enact your dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And so if all of that was proven, your chances to develop Parkinson's disease or another synucleinopathy, could be dementia with Lewy bodies or multiple system atrophy, one of the three, is more than 80% and probably close to 100%. If it's properly diagnosed, then all other causes of RBD were ruled out, like there are some medications that could cause symptoms of RBD. So if all these things are being ruled out and you have real pure RBD, then what you actually have is a prodromal synucleinopathy, which means that it's almost 100% that you'll develop one of the three diseases that I mentioned.
Okay. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's also related to the GBA pathway, right?
Yeah, very much, yeah.
How well characterized is the GBA pathway?
Well, luckily for us, GBA has been studied a lot before it was related to Parkinson's because it causes Gaucher's disease. So we have a lot of information from Gaucher patients who are carrying two mutations in GBA. So it is well characterized, I would say, but there's still a lot to learn, and a lot because we still don't know what we know that there's a mutation in GBA, but we don't know what is the effect of the mutation that leads to the accumulation of alpha-synuclein and developing Parkinson's disease. It's something in this pathway of GBA that is either the GBA gene is regulating levels of different lipids in the lysosome.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably some sort of dysregulation of these lipids that affect us. So we do know which lipids GBA is working on, but we still don't know what is the exact problem, what is accumulating or what is not being handled properly in the lysosome that leads to Parkinson's. There are some hints that it could be, for example, there's a lipid, glucosyl sphingosine. I think that's one of the top candidates, but we still don't know. But overall, because this GBA was studied for so long before it was related to Parkinson's, we know quite a lot about the pathway. But how it causes Parkinson's, I think we are still not there.
Is it in any way possible to say, to put a percent or a number on how well we actually know the pathway?
I can throw a number in the air, you know, but every different person that you will ask will give you a different number. I would say it's more than 50%, but far from 100%. Somewhere in between.
Okay, fair enough. And then the last question I wanted to ask is that there's currently a bunch of different approaches being tried to tackle GBA-related Parkinson's. there's Ambroxol trial and Sanofi Genzyme trial and Lysosomal Therapeutics trial and all sorts of other methods being developed. Could you give any insight into what you think will ultimately be the most successful or none of them? And that we'll need to go back to this drawing board in some sense.
I can tell you what worries me. What worries me, I know a lot about this trial because I'm consulting for some of these companies. So there are also things I'm not allowed to say. But I can tell you, first of all, something general about trials. We have a huge problem with the way we are doing clinical trials. Mm-hmm. Because first of all, we've been consistently failing for dozens of years now. Every single drug that goes through phase one that shows in mice models or whatever model that was used to develop the drug that shows that it's being neuroprotective or even reversing the process just doesn't work for humans. And the reason it doesn't work, there could be many reasons. It could be the model that we're using, just, you know, we're using mice and it works on mice and then it doesn't work on us, mm-hmm. which makes sense that it will not work. But also we've been treating Parkinson's as a single disease in the past, and now we know that it's not. We know that we have those with GBA mutations, those with LRRK2 mutations, those with other types. So trials that are targeting specifically GBA, a priori they should have bigger chances to succeed, but I'm very worried that they're all going to fail as well, or they have very high chances to fail as well. Because we have also an issue with the way we are doing the trials, and I will give you an example from a different field. From do you know the disease, the cystic fibrosis?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a disease where you have a single. It's a Mendelian disease. It's not like Parkinson's, which means that if you have mutations in this gene, two mutations in the two copies of the gene, you will have the disease 100%. It's not like GBA when you have just increased risk because you have a GBA mutation.
Yeah.
Okay. And so it's a single. It's a Mendelian disease, single gene, and there's over 1,000 mutations in this gene, okay, that causes the disease, causes cystic fibrosis. Now, there's a drug called ivacaftor. If you take this drug and you give it to all the patients with cystic fibrosis and you compare them to, you divide them to half, one, you give ivacaftor drug, the other half, you give them a placebo, you will not see an effect of the drug if you take all patients together. And I remind you, they all have mutation in one gene, just like GBA. Okay? It will not show any effect. But if you choose those, I think, 6 or 7 specific mutations, that if you carry these mutations, the drug will work for you. But it will not work for people with other mutations in the same gene. So in GBA, we could have the same problem because we treat GBA altogether. I'm sure that I know that in the clinical trials that are being done, they're trying to match between the groups of their placebo and the drug groups that will be balancing the types of mutations that they have. Mm-hmm. But that, I'm afraid, will also still not be enough. Because, for example, if you look at families with GBA mutations and Parkinson, there are some families like that that we can look at. And you have one person in the family who has the disease at the age of 40 and is, you know, progressing very fast, and his uncle, who also carry the same exact mutation, developed Parkinson's at the age of 75 and he progressing quite slowly. So there are other things that affect the rate of progression of the disease. Mm-hmm. Now, if you take your clinical trial group, your patients, and you divide them randomly to two groups, you can create a situation in which in one group you have patients that their progression of the disease is faster just by chance than the other group. Then the drug that you will give, it will be biased either way. It depends which group is the group that progresses faster, the placebo group or the trial group. If, for example, the placebo group is progressing a bit faster, you can think that your drug is actually working. Because you give your drug to your trial group, to your treatment group, and they progress slower, and then you say, oh, my drug works. And then when you go to a larger trial, phase 3 trial, boom, it fails. So I'm very worried about these things, but some companies are taking measures to try to understand what are the different factors that affect the rate of progression so that they can also balance between the groups. And that would be a great approach, I think. So I'm not very optimistic. Unrelated to whether the drugs are good or not, they can fail because of the factors that I just mentioned. So I'm not very optimistic. I'm still very pessimistic about the chances to succeed, but I think we're going in the right direction. That's all I can say about that.
Okay, fair enough. I understand. All right, well, thank you. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Sure.